painted Indians, dwarfs, the horse of knowledge and the learned pig, the stone eater, the man that swallows fire, giants, ventriloquists, the invisible girl, the bust that speaks and moves its goggling eyes, the waxwork, clockwork, all the marvellous craft of modern Merlins, wild beasts, puppet shows, all out the way far-fetched perverted things, all freaks of nature, all Promethean thoughts of man, his dullness, madness, and their feats, all jumbled up together to make up this parliament of monsters. Tents and booths, meanwhile, as if the whole were one vast mill, are vomiting, receiving on all sides men, women, 3 years' children, babes in arms. Oh, blank confusion.
Ian McKellen was reading from The Prelude, Wordsworth's autobiographical poem recorded in Dove Cottage, where it was written in 1805. It was produced by Susan Roberts, and you also heard from Robert Wolfe, the director of the Wordsworth Trust. And Sir Ian will read the final part of the poem at the same time, 3:15 tomorrow.
The great gardener Gertrude Jekyll once said, "A garden is a grand teacher. It teaches patience, it teaches industry and thrift."
In a day and age where everything is so easily available, I love Christmas pudding. Could not eat it every day. It's wonderful because it's only around for a week or two, and that's the wonderful thing about gardening.
Above all, it teaches entire trust.
Personally speaking, what gardening has taught me is that I never want to work in an office again.
Bravo.
Penelope Keith presents 3 hours of horticultural highlights from the BBC Sound Archives. Four Extra goes gardening this Saturday morning at 9 o'clock and again in the evening at 7.
BBC Radio 4 Extra.
Good afternoon, it's 3 o'clock. Hello, I'm Zeb Soans, and we've sparkling comedy from P.G. Woodhouse in this hour, as Martin Jarvis stars as the amiably absent-minded Clarence, 9th Earl of Emsworth, in the author's first visit to Blandings Castle. Can insects predict the weather? Mel will be finding out in the 4 o'clock show in an hour, and Miriam Margolyes will continue her sumptuous, we might even say juicy, reading of James and the Giant Peach. A comic masterpiece, first on 4 Extra from P.G. Woodhouse. Something Fresh was written in 1915, just prior to the First World War, and many of the delightfully dotty characters were to appear again over the years to come, as Woodhouse returned regularly to the idyllic idiocy of Blandings Castle. So pack a picnic, pop on a boater, and head out into the sunshine.
The sunshine of a fair spring morning fell graciously on London town. At 9 o'clock precisely, the front door of No. 7 Arundel Street, Leicester Square, opened, and a tall, fit-looking young man stepped out to begin his Larsen exercises.
And one, and two, and twist, and three, and four, and twist, and five, and six, and twist, and
The Larsen exercises are not dignified. Indeed, from the window of the first floor front, there rent the morning air a clear and musical laugh. It hit him like a bullet. Even as he turned, the laugh smote him afresh.
Something Fresh by P.G. Woodhouse, with Ewan Griffith, Helen McCrory, Hector Elizondo, Jared Harris, James Frayne, Joanne Whalley, Jill Gascoigne, Martin Jarvis, and Ian Ogilvie as Woodhouse.
Gridley Quail and the Wand of Death. Oh, Lord. Come in.
Oh, I'm afraid I'm disturbing you.
No. Oh, it's you.
I wanted to apologise for my abominable rudeness in laughing at you just now. It was idiotic of me, and I don't know why I did it. I'm sorry.
That's all right. They're Swedish.
What?
The exercises. I suppose seeing them for the first time, they could seem...
markedly humorous?
If you like. What is a wand of death?
I beg your pardon?
A wand of death. I'm trying to write a detective story about a wand of death.
Oh, really?
But actually, I can't write it without knowing what a wand of death is.
Well, yes, I see that.
Trouble is, having thought of such a splendid title, I don't want to jettison it offhand.
Ah, I was wondering whether you were a writer.
Why, do you write?
Yes. Do you ever read Home Gossip?
Never.
You're quite right. It's a horrid little paper. I do a short story for it every fortnight. A duke or an earl goes with each story. I loathe it intensely.
I'm sorry for your troubles, but what is a wand of death?
A wand of...
death.
Why, of course. It's the sacred ebony stick stolen from the Indian temple, which is supposed to bring death to whoever possesses it. The hero gets hold of it, the priests dog him and send him threatening messages. What else could it be?
Well, this is genius. I see it all. The hero calls in Gridley Quail, and that patronising ass, by the aid of a series of wicked coincidences, solves the mystery. And there am I, with another month's work done.
You aren't the author of Gridley Quail.
Don't tell me you read him.
I do not read him, but he's published by the same firm that publishes Home Gossip. I can't help seeing his cover sometimes.
So we are comrades in misfortune. Shall we introduce ourselves? By the way, you've not been here long, have you?
I took my room the day before yesterday. But your name, if you're the author of Gridley Quail, is Felix Clavelli, isn't it?
Heavens no. Felix Clavelli is only the cloak under which I hide my shame. My real name is Ashley Marson. Ash. And yours?
Joan Valentine.
Would you tell me the story of your life? Or shall I tell mine first? You were born?
I was.
Where?
In London.
Now we seem to have started. I was born in Much Middlefold.
I'm afraid I've never heard of it.
Well, I've not yet made it famous. In fact, I'm beginning to realise that I am one of its failures.
Failure?
What would you call a man whose only means of making a paltry living was the writing of Gridley Quail stories? An empire builder?
Then why don't you try something fresh?
Such as?
Well, how should I know? Read the advertisement columns. Snatch the next chance, whatever it is.
Continue. You're stimulating me.
Why should you want a girl like me to stimulate you? You can always find something new, surely. Listen, Mr. Marson, I was thrown on my own resources about 5 years ago, never mind how. Since then, I've worked in a shop, done typewriting, been on the stage, had a position as a lady's maid.
Lady's maid?
Why not? It was fun, and it gave me the opportunity of studying the aristocracy and its native haunts.
Look here, you have such pluck.
I keep on trying. I haven't achieved anything much yet, but I certainly don't feel like sitting back and calling myself a failure.
Well, you would galvanise a jellyfish. I feel like doing something big and adventurous.
Well, you have the Morning Post on the table. It may contain just the opening you want.
I'll scan it.
Goodbye, Mr. Marson. You've got your detective story to write, and I have to think out something with a duke in it by tonight, so I must get going. Oh, and again, I'm sorry that I laughed at you this morning.
I'm not. Come and laugh at me whenever you feel like it. Exercise 2 is funny without being vulgar. I'll start with it tomorrow morning. Don't miss it. Goodbye.
Well, well, well. The dashing bridegroom-to-be and no other. Congratulations, Freddy, on the engagement to Miss Peters.
Thanks very much, old man, and so forth.
The prodigal son, eh? Creeping back into the fold. The old governor put his foot down, eh, and stopped the funds. I take it things have loosened up a bit since the engagement was announced.
Well, as a matter of fact, Mr. Jones, old top, things are still pretty much the same. I managed to get away from Blandings for a night because the governor had to come to London, but I've got to go back with him on the afternoon train. Still can't get a quid out of him. That's why I've come to you.
Oh, well now... hardness of times.
Oh, I don't want to make a touch. As a matter of fact, I managed to raise 500 of the best this morning. That ought to be enough.
Well, it depends what you want it for.
Well, did you read about poor old Percy in the papers?
Percy?
Lord Stockheath, the court case, you know.
Oh, the Stockheath breach of promise case. Is he a pal of yours?
Cousin, actually. The fact is, Jonesy, I'm in exactly the same ballyhole as poor old Percy was.
What? Suit for breach of promise?
Not yet. Do you remember a show at the Piccadilly about a year ago called The Baby Doll? There was a girl in the chorus.
Several, I remember noticing.
No, I mean one particular girl. A girl called Joan Valentine. The rotten part is that I never met her.
Pull yourself together, Freddy. What exactly is the trouble?
Well, I used to go to the show every other night, and I fell frightfully in love with this girl.
Without having met her?
Yes. You see, I was rather an ass in those days.
Oh, no.
I must have been, or I shouldn't have been such an ass, don't you know? Well, as I was saying, I used to write this girl letters saying how much I was in love with her, and...
specifically proposing marriage?
I expect I did. I was awfully in love.
How was that if you never met her?
She wouldn't meet me, didn't even answer my letters. And then...
what then?
Well, poetry.
You wrote her poetry?
Yards of it, old top. This girl is bound to have kept the letters. She's got enough material to make it worthwhile to have a dash at an action, especially after poor old Percy made breach of promise cases the fashion, so to speak. Goodness knows what would happen at Blandings. My old governor would kill me. So you see what a frightful hole I'm in.
Well, what do you want me to do?
Why, get hold of this girl and get back the letters.
You said something about £500.
Here it is, old man. In notes. I brought it on purpose. Will you really take the thing on? Do you think you can work it for 500?
Well, Freddy, old bean, I can have a try. Certainly don't want to see Lord Emsworth done for murder.
Good afternoon, my lord. Don't often see your lordship in the club.
What? Oh, no, Adams. I seldom visit London nowadays. It doesn't attract me. The country, on the other hand, the fields, the woods, birds, pigs. Well, what was I saying, Adams?
The pigs, my lord.
What?
You were speaking of the attractions of life in the country, your lordship. You included pigs in your remarks.
Oh, yes. Yes. You have to be sure. Pigs. Yes. I say, Adams, who's the gentleman over by the window?
That is Mr. Simmons, my lord. He joined us last year.
I never saw a man take such large mouthfuls. That man's digging his grave with his teeth. Do you take large mouthfuls, Adams?
No, my lord.
That's quite right. Very sensible. What was I saying?
About my not taking large mouthfuls, your lordship.
Good. Never gobble, Adams. Americans gobble when young and ruin their digestions. My American friend, Mr. Peters, suffers terribly from indigestion.
If you will pardon the liberty, your lordship, I saw it in the paper.
Well, about Mr. Peters' indigestion?
About Miss Peters, my lord, and the Honourable Frederick. May I be permitted to offer my congratulations?
Eh? Oh, yes, engagement, yeah, to be sure. Very satisfactory in every respect. High time he settled down, got a little sense. So you saw the news in the paper, did you, Adams?
Yes, my lord. And the Honourable Frederick's photograph and the young lady's, if I may say so, your lordship, a beautiful young lady.
Devilish attractive, Adams, and devilish rich. Mr. Peters is a millionaire, Adams.
So I read, my lord.
Damn me, they all seem to be millionaires in America. Wish I knew how they managed it. Honestly, I hope. Mr. Peters is an honest man, but his digestion's bad. He used to bolt his food. What cheese would you recommend, Adams?
The gentlemen are speaking well of the Gorgonzola.
All right, bring me some. You know, Adams, what I admire about Americans is their resource. Mr. Peters tells me that as a boy of 11, he earned $20 a week selling mint to saloon keepers. Why they wanted mint, I cannot recollect. Mr. Peters explained the reason to me. It seemed highly plausible at the time, but I've forgotten it. Possibly for mint sauce. Every man ought to have an earning capacity. I was so struck with what he told me that I began to paint.
Landscapes, my lord?
Furniture. I painted the whole of my bedroom at Blandings and am now engaged on the museum. You'd be surprised at the fascination of it. Tell me, Adams, have I eaten my cheese?
Not yet, your lordship. I was about to send the waiter for
you. No, never mind. Tell him to bring the bill instead. I remember I have an appointment with Mr. Peters to view his collection of scarabs. Yes. Or was it Arabs? No, scarabs. Of course, you couldn't collect Arabs. No, I mustn't be late.
Shall I take the fork, your lordship?
Fork?
Your lordship has inadvertently put a fork in your coat pocket.
Hmm? Ah, good heavens. That's deuce peculiar. I have no recollection of placing that fork in my pocket. Yeah. Well, good day, Adams. I'm not quite certain what scarabs might be. I rather think they're a kind of fish. Good day.
What a nut.
My esteemed Lord Emsworth, I'd have asked you to lunch here, but you know how it is with me. I've promised the doctor I'll give those nuts and grasses and legumes of his a fair trial. And to have to sit by and see somebody else eating real food would be trying me too high.
Oh, yes, yes, quite. Too bad.
And now, Lord Emsworth, these are my scarabs. My hobby, as you know, is the collecting of scarabs.
Yes. As a matter of fact, Peters, what are scarabs?
Oh, scarabs, my good lord, are the Egyptian hieroglyphs.
Oh, yes. And what are Egyptian hieroglyphs?
Well, a scarab, derived from the Latin scarabaeus, is literally a beetle.
Oh, lord.
Scarabs are Egyptian symbols in the form of beetles.
Are they really?
The most common form of scarab is in the shape of a ring. Scarabs were used for seals, you know.
Seals? Oh. Good gracious.
Well, some scarabaei bear inscriptions having reference to places, as, for instance, Memphis is mighty forever.
Go on.
And just take a look at this, Lord Emsworth.
Hmm?
a Cheops of the Fourth Dynasty.
I beg your pardon?
A Cheops of the Fourth Dynasty. Take it, stroke it, feel it.
Ah, oh, dear me. A Cheops.
Of the Fourth Dynasty.
Dynasty? Oh, bless my soul.
So what do you think of that, huh?
If you please, Mr. Peters, the Honourable Frederick Threepwood wishes to speak with you on the telephone.
Oh, your son. Pardon me for one moment.
Oh, certainly, certainly. By all means. Oh, that's better. Beetles? Seals? Extraordinary. Mm-hmm. What's this? It's curious. Bless my soul. Well, it's probably something, but... And there were... What time's my train?
At about the same hour that Lord Emsworth placed the strange little object in his pocket, a party of two sat at a table at Simpson's restaurant in the Strand. One was a small, pretty, good-natured-looking girl of about 20, Aileen Peters. The other was a thick-set young man with a wiry crop of red-brown hair, George Emerson, home on leave from Hong Kong.
The girl you ought to marry is Joan Valentine.
The girl I'm going to marry is Aileen Peters.
George, you're simply trying to make me angry. You know perfectly well how fatal it is to get angry at meals. It was eating while he was in a bad temper that ruined Father's digestion.
Aileen, why is it that everyone in London looks exactly the same as everyone else? You see that fellow over there? Look at the stodgy face. See the glassy eye. If that man sandbagged your Freddy and tied him up somewhere and turned up at the church instead of him, can you honestly tell me you would know the difference? Wouldn't you simply go through the ceremony without a suspicion?
He isn't a bit like Freddy. And you oughtn't to speak of him as Freddy. You don't know him.
Yes, I do. And what is more, he expressly asked me to call him Freddy. Oh, dash it, old top. Don't keep calling me Threepwood. Freddy to pals, those were his very words.
George, you are making this up.
I'm not. We met last night at the National Sporting Club. Threepwood chummed up with me. He said how ripping to meet a policeman and fancy being stationed out in China.
Well, you're simply trying to poison my mind against him.
What do you mean? You know perfectly well you don't love him. You're not going to marry him. You are going to marry me.
Nonsense. What excellent meat they have in England.
Aileen, I don't want to sit here discussing food products.
If you were in my position, George, you wouldn't want to talk about anything else. You don't know what it means for a healthy young girl to try and support life on nuts and grasses and legumes.
Just because your father has to live on that stuff, why should you let him make you do the same?
He doesn't make me. I do it to encourage him.
All right, then. If you really are starving yourself of your own free will, there is no more to say.
But you are going to say it, aren't you, George?
Yes. Your father has got you hypnotized, and you won't break away from this Freddy foolishness because you can't find the nerve. Well, I'm going to help you. I'm coming down to Blandings Castle when you go there on Friday.
Coming to Blandings?
Freddy invited me last night, and I accepted.
But, George, you can't take advantage of his hospitality to try to steal his fiancée away from him.
Watch me.
I wonder what it feels like, being a countess.
Listen, my poor girl, I have been in love with you ever since we first met on the Olympic. I proposed to you twice on the voyage and once in the train on the way to London. That was 8 months ago. I go to Scotland for a few weeks to see my people, and when I come back, what do I find? That you're engaged to this Freddy excrescence.
I do like your chivalrous attitude towards Freddy. So many men in your position might say horrid things about him.
Oh, I've nothing against Freddy. He's practically an imbecile, and I don't like his face. Outside of that, he's all right. But you will be glad later that you did not marry him.
George, I am fond of you, but we are not suited.
Why not?
You are too much like a bomb. You would want your own way and nothing but your own way. I expect it's through having to be constantly moving people on, out in Hong Kong and all that sort of thing. I am much too placid and mild to make you happy. You want somebody who would stand up to you. Somebody like Joan Valentine.
Who is this Joan Valentine?
She was at school with me. I was at school here in England, you know. We were the greatest chums. At least, I worshipped her, and I think she liked me. Then I went back to America, and we lost touch. I met her on the street yesterday. Oh, she has been through the most awful times. She worked in a shop, and went on the stage, and all sorts of things. Oh, isn't it awful, George?
Oh, frightful.
She is so plucky and full of life. She would stand up to you.
Thanks, but my idea of marriage is not a perpetual fight. My notion of a wife is something cozy and sympathetic and soothing. That is why I love you. We shall be the happiest...
George, Freddy is my betrothed, not you.
Curious how you cling to that Freddy idea. Never mind. I'll come down to Blandings on Friday and we shall see what happens. Bear in mind that you and I are going to be married and that nothing on earth is going to stop us. Waiter, my bill, please.
Now, how in the world did that get there?
Lord Emsworth?
I found a curious object in my pocket, Baxter. I was wondering how it got there. Look.
Magnificent, superb.
What?
It is a scarab, Lord Emsworth, and unless I'm mistaken, may I? Yes, it's a Cheops of the 4th Dynasty. What a wonderful addition to your museum.
Is it? Oh, by God, you don't say so.
It is, indeed. Oh, it must have been the gem of somebody's collection. Was there a sale at Christie's this afternoon?
Oh, I didn't get it at Christie's. I recollect I had an important engagement this afternoon. Yes, I'd promised to call on Mr. Peters and examine his collection of... what was it? It was to do with seals.
Well, Mr. Peters is one of the best-known living collectors of scarabs.
Scarabs? You're quite right, Baxter. Now that I recall the episode, this is a scarab, and Mr. Peters gave it to me.
Gave it to you, Lord Emsworth?
Yes. The whole scene comes back to me. Mr. Peters, after telling me a great many exceedingly interesting things about scarabs, which I regret to say I cannot remember, gave me this. You say it's valuable, Baxter?
From a collector's point of view, of extraordinary value.
Oh, bless my soul. Ah, exceedingly kind of Mr. Peters. I shall certainly treasure it. Though I must confess that from a purely spectacular standpoint, it leaves me a little cold. Time to dress for dinner. Baxter, you'll be going past the museum door. Be a good fellow. Place this among the exhibits.
Certainly.
I always think of you as the curator of my little collection, as well as my efficient secretary, of course.
Thank you, my love.
Mind how you step when you're in the museum. I was painting a chair there yesterday. I think I left the paint pot on the floor. Frederick, get up. Go and dress for dinner.
Yeah, hey, Governor.
Now make haste. Beach has rung the gong. What's that trash you're reading?
Oh, just a book, Governor. It's pretty spiffing, actually. Gridley Quayle, Investigator, The Adventure of the Secret Six. Bit of an ambition of mine to meet the fellow who writes them, a chap called Felix Clavelli.
I wonder you can waste your time on it. Make haste. Come along, Bex.
My lord.
Extremely kind of Mr. Peters, don't you think?
Mm.
Really, there's something almost oriental in the lavish generosity of our American cousins. Huh? Don't you think?
God damn it! The darned old sneak thief! Trust him to walk off with the pick of the bunch! My Cheops! Didn't mean to steal it. Of course he meant to steal it. He has a museum of his own. I'd sooner trust a syndicate of Jesse James, Captain Kidd, and Dick Turpin. There's no morality among collectors, none. Right, if there's a man in this country with the spirit to break into that castle and steal that scarab and hand it back to me, there's $5,000 waiting for him right here. Aileen!
Miss Valentine?
Please. Come in.
Not much light on your stairs.
No. Will you take a seat?
Thanks.
You wish to see me on business?
Yes, Miss Valentine. You don't know me. Name's Jones. I've come here on a very distasteful errand to oblige a friend.
Are you collecting funds for a charity?
No. I came here at the request of the Honourable Frederick Threepwood.
I don't quite understand.
Oh, you never met him, Miss Valentine. But when you were in the chorus... at the Piccadilly Theatre, I believe. He wrote you some very foolish letters. Possibly you have forgotten them.
I certainly have.
You have probably destroyed them, eh?
Certainly. I never keep letters. Why do you ask?
Well, you see, Miss Valentine, the Honourable Frederick is about to be married, and he thought that possibly, on the whole, it would be better that the letters and poetry which he wrote you were non-existent.
He was afraid I might try to blackmail him.
Oh, my dear Miss Valentine.
Please tell Mr. Threepwood to make his mind quite easy. He's in no danger.
Exactly. Precisely. I may tell him definitely then that you have destroyed the letters?
Yes, good evening.
I'm obliged. Good evening, Miss Valentine. I beg your pardon, miss. I didn't see you there. Good night.
Aileen? Is that you?
Yes. I'm so sorry, Joan.
My dear girl. I can see you're worried about something. Come in and tell me all about it.
Well, it's nothing at all, really. I think I've been making rather a fuss about very little.
Well, never mind. Sit down and tell me what this very little thing was.
It was only Father.
Was he angry with you about something?
Not exactly angry with me, but, well, I was kind of there.
What a shame. Tell me all about it.
Oh, dear. Well, you may remember, Joan, that my father has a priceless collection of scarabs. It seems my future father-in-law, the Earl of Emsworth, has stolen... So Father is saying he would give $5,000 to anyone who would get his Cheops back for him.
That's £1,000. He wasn't serious, surely.
I think he was.
But £1,000? The condition my finances are perpetually in makes even £100 a sum to be gasped at.
You don't understand how Father loves his scarabs. Since he retired from business, he has... Did you hear something, Ben?
Probably someone from the top floor groping his way down. Then you mean to say that your father would really give £1,000 to anyone who got this thing back for him?
I'm sure he would. But who could do it?
I could. And what's more, I'm going to.
But
it's perfectly simple. This Earl of yours has taken this thing off to his castle, like a brigand. You say that you're going down there on Friday. All you have to do is take me along with you, sit back, and watch me get busy.
But Joan...
Where's the difficulty?
Well, if you went down there as a friend of mine and were caught stealing the scarab, there would be just the trouble Father wants to avoid. About my engagement, you see, and so on. Father says you can't go about the place charging a man with theft and ask him to go on being willing to have his son marry your daughter.
Yes, I see. But there must be a way.
Joan, don't think any more about it.
My child, do you even faintly realise what £1,000 or even a quarter of £1,000 means to me? Of course. You shall take me as your lady's maid.
But Joan...
Why not?
Well...
Aileen, my pet, I need that money. I need it worse than anybody has ever needed anything. And I'm going to have it. From now on, until further notice, I'm your lady's maid.
But it's simply ridiculous. The other servants would find you out.
My dear Aileen, you can't stump me on below stairs etiquette. I've been a lady's maid.
Joan!
3 years ago, the wolf was glued to the door like a postage stamp. So I answered an advertisement and became a lady's maid.
You seem to have done everything.
I have. Well, pretty nearly. It's all right for you idle rich, Aileen, but we poor working girls have got to hustle.
You know, you always could make me do anything you wanted, Joan. I suppose I've got to look on this as quite settled now?
Absolutely settled. Oh, and don't call me Joan when I'm down at the castle. You must call me Valentine. Oh, no, of course, Valentine wouldn't do. It's too jaunty anyway. I want something more respectable.
Simpson?
Simpson? Simpson. It's exactly right. Say it kindly, yet distantly. As though I were a worm. But a worm for whom you felt a mild liking.
Simpson.
Now again a little more haughtily?
Simpson. Simpson?
That's wonderful. You might have been doing it all your life.
What are you laughing at?
Oh, I was just thinking. There's a young man who lives upstairs, and I was lecturing him yesterday on Enterprise. I told him to go and find something exciting to do. I wonder what he would say if he knew how thoroughly I'm going to practice what I preach.
Wanted. Young man of good appearance who is poor and reckless to undertake a delicate and dangerous enterprise. Good pay for the right man. Apply between the hours of 10 and 12 at offices of... Well, why not?
So, do you get it? If you're willing, you can do it. If you're not willing, you can leave it and go to the devil.
Oh, I get it. I think. Only one point puzzles me, Mr. Peters. You want to hire the right man to go down to Blanding's castle and get this scarab back for you. I followed that, but why must he go as your valet?
Don't be a damn fool. If I engaged a new secretary and he was caught trying to steal my scarab from the Earl of Emsworth's collection, it would look suspicious. But a valet is different. Anyone can get fooled by a crook valet with bogus references.
Well, suppose your accomplice does get caught. What then?
That is the catch, Marson. You've got to look after yourself. I couldn't say a word. And if I did, it would all come out. And so far as the breaking off of my daughter's engagement to young Threepwood is concerned, it would be just as bad as though I had tried to get the thing back myself. If you get caught, you take what's coming to you without a word. That's why I'm offering good pay. Whoever carries this job through gets $5,000 cash.
$5,000? £1,000?
Yes, don't gape. Try to look intelligent.
When do I begin?
You'll do it?
For £1,000, I certainly will.
With your eyes open?
Wide open.
Good boy. Be at Paddington Station at 4 o'clock on Friday. And don't forget, I won't utter a syllable of protest if they want to hang you.
Thank you. I'm beginning to understand why you call the job delicate and dangerous. Miss Valentine, your door was open, so...
Oh, come in, Mr. Marsden.
You know what you told me about doing something fresh? Well, I've just got a job. As a valet.
A valet? To whom?
To a man named Peters, an American.
Not J. Preston Peters?
Yes. Do you know him?
His daughter's just engaged me as a lady's maid. I'm travelling with her to Blandings and Shropshire on Friday.
What?
Well, it's just a cheap way of getting a holiday, really. I used to know Miss Peters very well, you see. It'll be more like going as her guest.
But I say, what a coincidence. I'm going down there with Mr. Peters.
I see. By the way, what put it into your head to be a valet? Seems such a curious thing for you to think of doing.
Well, the experience will be useful to me, of course, in my writing.
Seems odd. How did you happen to get in touch with Mr. Peters?
I answered an advertisement, like you told me.
Oh.
It will be nice, being together.
Very.
Yes, well, goodbye for the present.
Goodbye. Ah, young man of good appearance. Apply. Offices of... You are quite a nice young man, Mr. Marsden, but you mustn't try to jump my claim. I dare say you need that money too, but I'm afraid you must go without. I'm going to have it, and nobody else.
In a first-class smoking compartment, Mr. J. Preston Peters was lighting a big black cigar. Further along the corridor, in a first-class non-smoking compartment, Aileen Peters looked through the window and thought of many things. And a long way down the train...
Well, Mr. Marsden, here we are.
Exactly what I was thinking, Miss Valentine.
Second class. I'm sure you know that in English trains only the tipping classes travel first. Valets, ladies' maids, footmen and nurses second, and housemaids, grooms and inferior stillroom maids third.
I suppose but for these social distinctions, the whole fabric of society would collapse and anarchy stalk naked through the land.
Undoubtedly. And are you sorry or glad that you let me persuade you to do this perfectly mad thing? I feel responsible, you know. If it had not been for me, you would have been comfortably in Arundel Street, writing your Wand of Death.
I'm glad.
Good. Though Mr. Peters seems likely to be a rather trying man to work for.
Yes, he has dyspepsia.
I know.
What he needs is plenty of fresh air, no cigars, and a regular course of those Larsen exercises that amuse you so much.
Are you going to try and persuade Mr. Peters to twist himself about like that?
Don't you think he would resent it from a valet?
Well, I keep forgetting you're a valet. You look so unlike one.
Well, I suppose you know that despite the sober dress, you don't look in the least like a lady's maid. You're amazingly pretty. You look like a disguised princess.
Well, that's very nice of you, Mr. Marsden. But anyone could tell I was a lady's maid, a mile away.
I don't think your expression is right. You aren't meek enough.
Meek? Why should she be meek? Doesn't she go in after the groom of the chambers?
Go in? Go in where?
Into dinner. Etiquette. Didn't you know that the rules of precedence among the servants of a big country house in England are more rigid and complicated than in English society?
You're joking.
I'm not. You try going into dinner out of your proper place when we get to Blandings and see what happens. A public rebuke from the butler is the least you could expect.
My God, if a butler publicly rebuked me, I think I should commit suicide. I couldn't survive it. Tell me all you know.
Well, however large the house party is, Mr. Peters is sure to be the principal guest. So, as his valet, your standing will be correspondingly magnificent. You will come in after the butler, the housekeeper, the groom of the chambers, Lord Emsworth's valet. After them will come Frederick Threepwood's valet and myself, and then you.
I'm not so high up then, after all.
Well, yes, you are. There's a whole crowd who come after you. Listen, kitchen maids and scullery maids eat in the kitchen. Chauffeurs, footmen, underbutler, pantry boys and stewards' room footmen take their meals in the servants' hall. The stillroom maids have breakfast and tea in the stillroom and dinner and supper in the hall.
Hang on.
The housemaids have breakfast and tea in the housemaid's sitting room and dinner and supper in the hall. The head housemaid ranks next to the head stillroom maid and the chef has his meals in a room of his own near the kitchen. Got it? We stop at Swindon in half an hour. Don't you think it would be wise to get out there and go straight back to London? Think of all you would avoid.
It's a nightmare.
You would be far happier in Arundel Street. Why don't you get out at Swindon and go back?
I can't. There's a reason.
Well, suit yourself, Mr. Marson. Though I can't help smiling a little.
If girls realized their responsibilities, they would be so careful when they smiled that they would probably abandon the practice altogether. There are moments in a man's life when a girl's smile can have as important results as an explosion of dynamite. It was precisely at that moment that Ash became conscious, to the very depths of his being, that a future in which Joan did not figure would be so insupportable as not to bear considering. And in the immediate present, he very strongly favored the idea of clasping Joan in his arms and kissing her until further notice.
Market landings. Market landing station. A light here for market landings.
Our employees, of course, are being met by the Om Freddy in the automobile. I'll just go and tuck Aileen into it. There'll be a cart for us. I hope it's a covered cart. I'm frozen. Well, come along, Mr. Marson. Exciting, isn't it?
Welcome to Blandings. I'm Maisie, head stillroom maid. I'm to conduct you to the presence of Mrs. Twemlow, the housekeeper, if you please.
Thank you, Maisie.
This way.
Oh, good luck, Mr. Marson.
Sir, pardon me. I'm Noreen, head housemaid. Be so good as to follow me to the butler's pantry where Mr. Beach awaits to do you honour.
Mr. Beach? Who's he?
Oh, well, Mr. Beach is the butler, sir. And you're the valet of the castle's most important guest, Mr. Peters.
Oh, splendid. Yes, yes, of course. Well, lead on.
Yes, please, come in.
The gentleman, Mr. Beach.
Ah, yes. I have not the advantage of your name, Mr.
Marson. I am valet to Mr. Peters.
Indeed. You must have had a cold ride, Mr. Marson. The wind is in the east.
Yes, the ride was cold.
When the wind is in the east, I suffer from my feet.
I beg your pardon?
I suffer from my feet. Corns.
I'm sorry.
Not only corns, I have but recently recovered from an ingrowing toenail. I suffered greatly from my ingrowing toenail. I suffer from swollen joints.
Well, I'm sorry. You must have had a bad time. Is there a large house party here just now?
We are expecting a number of guests. An opportunity for our family and outlying relations to acquaint themselves with Miss Peters and her father. We shall in all probability sit down 30 to dinner.
Goodness, a responsibility for you.
You are right, Mr. Marson. Few persons realize the responsibilities of a man in my position. Sometimes, I can assure you, it preys on my mind, and I suffer from nervous headaches.
Ash began to feel like a man trying to put out a fire, which as fast as he checks it at one point, breaks out at another.
Sometimes when I come off duty, everything gets blurred. The outline of objects grow indistinct and misty. I have to sit down in a chair. The pain is excruciating.
But it helps you to forget the pain in your feet.
No, I suffer from my feet simultaneously.
Ah, well.
You have been with Mr. Peters some time, Mr. Marson?
Oh, no, only since last Wednesday.
Indeed. Might I inquire whom you assisted before that?
Well, to tell the truth, this is my first situation. I was doing something else before I met Mr. Peters.
Your first situation? Indeed.
Yes, something fresh. I might have had better luck. I dare say you know how bad-tempered Mr. Peters is. He has sufferings. He's dyspeptic.
So I have been informed. I, too, suffer from my stomach.
Oh. Well, do tell me, Mr. Beach, all about the lining of your stomach.
Well, Mr. Marson, I have a weak stomach. The lining of my stomach is not what I could wish the lining of my stomach to be. You can imagine, Mr. Marson. Oh, so late. I shall have to be going about my duties. And you also, Mr. Marston, if I may make the suggestion. No doubt Mr. J. Preston Peters will be wishing to have your assistance in preparing for dinner.
Yes, yes, of course.
Now, if you go along the passage outside and up the steps, you will come to the green baize door that separates our portion of the house from the other. I must beg you now to excuse me. I have to go to the cellar.
Right. I'm obliged to you, Mr. Beach.
So, here we go. Green baize, jolly good. Oh, the main hall. Very pleasant. Log fire. Broad staircase leading, no doubt, to the upper regions. But how am I to ascertain which room is the one assigned to my employer?
Oh, I say, old man, would you mind telling me how I get to Mr. Peters' room? I've lost my bearings.
Certainly. My name's Rupert Baxter. I'm Lord Emsworth's private secretary. Mr. Peters' room is up the staircase, second to the left, on the second floor. You can't miss it. Forgive me, you are...
Thank you. Oh, is that the Blandings Museum along there I've heard so much about?
Indeed it is, Mr...
Well, up I go. I'm much obliged. You lose your way in a place like this. Pip, pip.
What do you want? Oh, it's you, is it? God damn it, Marston, I hate this dressing for dinner. Can you tie a damn bow tie? Don't stand there. Do it. Hustle.
Well, stand still, then. Now, left over right. Up. There's the tree. Round we go. Wrap it down the hole, and voila. A snow-white butterfly.
Yeah. It's not bad. Why be obliged to deck up for a feast when it consists of asparagus and a few nuts? Give me my cigar. You located the scarab yet?
No.
What the devil have you been doing? You've had time to collar it a dozen times.
I've been talking to the butler.
Why do you waste time talking to butlers? Suppose you haven't even located the museum yet?
Yes, I've done that. I've just spotted it off the main hall.
Oh, well, that's something. And how do you propose setting about the job?
Well, the best plan would be to go there very late at night.
Well, you didn't propose to stroll in the afternoon, did you? How are you going to find the scarab when you do get in?
Ah, I don't know.
Tell me, young man, are you considered pretty bright as Englishmen go?
I really couldn't say.
Oh, you couldn't, could you? You boneheaded boob. Why don't you show a little more enterprise? I want results. I want them quick. I'll tell you how you can recognize my scarab. That shameless old crook who sneaked it from me has had the impudence to put it all by itself with a notice as big as a circus poster alongside of it saying that it is a Cheops of the Fourth Dynasty presented by J. Preston Peters, Esquire. That's how you're going to recognize it. Why are you laughing?
I'm not laughing. I just nearly seem to have dislocated a rib, that's all.
Well, the thing isn't even in a glass case. It's lying on an open tray on top of a cabinet of Roman coins. It's criminal carelessness to leave a valuable scarab about like that. If he was going to steal my Cheops, he might at least have had the decency to treat it as though it was worth something.
But, Mr. Peters, it makes it easier for me to get it.
It's got to be made easy if you are to get it. And what are you going to do if anyone catches you prowling around at that time? Have you considered that?
No.
What you would say is this. You would explain that I'd rung for you to come and read me to sleep. Do you understand?
You think that would be a satisfactory explanation of my being in the museum?
Idiot. I don't mean that you're to say it if you're actually caught in the museum. You're to say it if you're found wandering about on your way there.
It sounds thin to me.
Does it? Well, let me tell you, it's what you will actually have to do most nights. Two nights out of three, I have to be read to sleep. My indigestion gives me insomnia. Oh, hand me that digestive tablet. The lining of my stomach is all wrong.
Oh, please, not that. Now listen, how do you expect not to have indigestion? You take no exercise and you smoke all day long.
What?
Your sort of man makes me angry. You smoke strong cigars on an empty stomach, and when you get indigestion as a natural result, you make the lives of everybody you meet miserable. If you would put yourself in my hands for a month, I would have you eating bricks and thriving on them. Up in the morning, Larson exercises. Cold bath, a brisk rub down, sharp walk.
Who the devil asked your opinion, you impertinent young hound?
Don't interrupt, confound you.
What? You infernal impudent.
Don't talk to me like that.
I'll talk to you.
Ah, very well then. I resign. You can get somebody else to do this job for you.
Hey, now wait.
Look, if I had known what being your valet involved, I wouldn't have undertaken the thing for $100,000. Do you realize what you've let me in for? How on earth am I to remember whether I go in before the chef or after the third footman?
I shan't have a peaceful minute in this place. I've got to sit and listen to a bore of a butler who seems to be a sort of walking hospital. And you have the immortal rhyme to suppose that I will stand for being nagged and bullied by you. So if you want this scarab of yours recovered, let somebody else do it. I've retired. Goodbye.
No, wait, wait. My boy, my dear boy, be reasonable.
You can't get out of it like that. Goodbye.
All right. I was hasty.
Throw away that cigar.
My boy.
Throw it away. If I am to stop here, you must put yourself in my hands as though I were your doctor. No more cigars. Every morning, regular exercises. Cold baths.
A cold bath would kill me.
Very well.
No, no. Yes, yes.
Do you consent to the cold baths?
Yes.
You promise?
Yes. All right, then.
We settled that just in time.
Young man, if after all this you fail to recover my Cheops for me, By George, I'll skin you.
And that's another thing. If my treatment is to be successful, you must not let yourself think in that way. You must exercise self-control mentally. You must think beautiful thoughts.
The idea of skinning you is a beautiful thought.
Mr. Marson, I bid you welcome. My name is Mrs. Twemlow. I'm housekeeper here at the castle. It is the custom for us upper servants at Blandings to postpone the going into the steward's room to commence our evening meal until dinner is nearly over above stairs. This enables Mr. Beach to take his place at the head of our table without fear of interruption.
Well, I must say, Mrs. Twemlow...
Twemlow,
I do beg your pardon, Mrs. Twemlow. I must say, it's amazing that so many high-class domestics should be collected into one moderate-sized room.
I thank you. Now, full introductions. Miss Simpson, you know.
Oh, do I?
Of course we know each other. How do you do again, Mr. Marson?
Oh, yes. How do you do, Miss Simpson?
And this is Mr. Judson, the Honourable Frederick's gentleman.
You've not the pleasure of our Freddy's acquaintance as yet, I take it, Mr. Marson?
Not yet.
Our Freddy repays inspection.
Oh, really?
Mr. Marson, permit me to introduce you to Mr. Ferris, Lord Stockheath's gentleman, member of the house party.
Happy to meet you, Mr. Marson.
How do you do?
Miss Willoughby, this is Mr. Marson, who will take you in to dinner.
A pleasure, Mr. Marson.
Miss Willoughby is Lady Mildred Mant's lady, house party. As, of course, you are aware, Lady Mildred, our eldest daughter, is married to Colonel Horace Mant of the Scots Guards.
How interesting that you have a daughter whose name is Lady Mildred. Oh, of course. You meant she's the,
Offspring of the Earl of Emsworth and his late Countess.
Quite. Well, Miss Willoughby, I've seen a number of plays in London. Are you by any chance an enthusiast of the drama?
Indeed, Mr. Marson. Colonel Mant's military duties keep him much in town. I've had wide opportunities of indulging my tastes. I do not like the country. I find it dull. Don't you think the country dull, Mr. Marson?
I shan't find it dull here, Miss Willoughby.
Mr. Marson.
It is Mr. Beach, Mrs. Twemlow. Oh,
good evening, Mr. Beach.
Good evening, Mr. Beach. Alfred spilled the hock, Mrs. Twemlow, within half an inch of his lordship's arm. He spilled it.
Oh, Mr. Beach, my sincere condolences.
I don't know, Mrs. Twemlow. I really don't know how long the strain of this can be supported.
Mr. Beach, if you please, dinner is served.
Yes, yes, yes. All right. Take my arm, Mrs. Twemlow.
Miss Willoughby, if you please.
Not yet, Mr. Marson.
Whoops. Miscalculating degrees of rank in spite of all. So sorry.
You were nearly making a bloomer out there, Mr. Marson. You must be absent-minded, like his lordship.
Is Lord Emsworth absent-minded?
Why, he forgets his own name sometimes. If it wasn't for Mr. Baxter, goodness knows what would happen to him.
Mr. Baxter?
Don't tell anyone I said so, but he's the real master here. His lordship's secretary, he calls himself, but is really everything rolled into one, like the man in the Mikado.
Oh, do you mean Pooh Bah?
Nosy Parker's what I call him. He minds everybody's business as well as his own. You've seen Miss Peters, of course, Mr. Marson?
Just for a few minutes at Paddington.
Oh, you haven't been with Mr. Peters long, then?
Only a day or so.
Where were you before that?
Oh, I was... that is to say...
How are you feeling after the journey, Mr. Marson?
Thank you, Miss Simpson. Very well, I think. Very well.
Do you agree, Mr. Marson, that the various railroad systems of Great Britain are quite defective in many respects.
We are all extremely sorry, Mr. Ferris, to read of your misfortune.
Oh, yes, Mr. Beach, we made a pretty poor show in court. There is no concealing the fact. Poor Percy's not bright.
All the papers said the girl was attractive, but she didn't look anything special to me from her photograph in the Daily Sketch.
Well, the photo didn't quite do her justice, Mrs. Twemlow. I was present in court, and I must admit she was svelte, decidedly svelte.
We are speaking of the Stockheath breach of promise case, Miss Simpson. Lord Stockheath is a nephew of ours. I fancy Lord Emsworth was greatly shocked at the occurrence.
He was. I happened to overhear him speak of it to young Freddy. He says to Freddy,
if anything of this sort happens to you, you young scallywag.
Mr. Judson.
Now, it's all right, Mr. Beach. We're all in the family here. I'm sure none of these ladies and gentlemen will let it go beyond this room.
No secret safe with me.
His lordship says to Freddy,
anything of this sort happens to you, you can back up and go off to Canada.
And Freddy says, dash it all, Governor, you know. What?
Mr. Judson is clever, isn't he, Mr. Marson?
Be careful, Mr. Judson. Tell me, Mr. Ferris, does his lordship seem to bear it well?
Oh, Cousin Percy's bearing it well enough. The damage is not having come out of his pocket. It is old father who had to pay them that's taking it to heart.
Oh, it has been a most unfortunate occurrence. The modern tendency of the lower classes to get above themselves is becoming more marked every day. The young female in this case was, I understand, barmaid.
The wonder to me, Mr. Beach, is that young Freddy hasn't been up against it. When we was in London, Freddy and I, before his governor cut off supplies and had him come back and live here, Freddy was asking for it, believe me. Fell in love with a girl in the chorus of one of the theatres. What was her name? It's on the tip of my tongue. Freddy was pretty far gone. I recollect once happening to be looking around his room in his absence, coming on a poem he'd written to her. It was hot stuff. Very hot. If that girl has kept one of those letters, it's my belief we shall see Freddy following in Lord Stockheath's footsteps.
Well, you don't say so, Mr. Judson. It wouldn't half make them look silly if the Honourable Frederick was sued for breach just now with the wedding coming on.
Well, there's no danger of that.
What makes you say that, Miss Simpson?
Well, I meant, I don't think it at all likely that he proposed marriage to this girl.
My impression is that Freddy did. Before he went to London with his lordship the other day, he was behaving very strange. And since he's come back, it's my belief he's been brooding.
And in any case, Miss Simpson, with the juries drawn from the lower classes, it don't seem hardly necessary in these affairs for there to have been any definite promise of marriage. What with all this socialism rampant, they seem so happy at the idea of being able to do one of us an injury that they give heavy damages without it. A few ardent expressions, and that's enough for them. What it comes to is that anarchy is getting the upper hand. It's all these here cheap newspapers that does it. They tempt the lower classes to get above themselves.
Well, I hope to goodness nothing won't happen to Freddy of that kind. For it's not every girl that would have him.
You can say that again.
Now, Miss Simpson, you're Miss Peters. She seems a nice little thing.
She would be pleased to hear you say so.
Joan Valentine.
What?
Joan Valentine. I've just remembered it. That was the name of the girl Freddy used to write the letters and poems to. And that's who it is I've been trying all along to think you remind me of, Miss Simpson. You're the living image of Freddy's Miss Joan Valentine.
Oh, am I?
I say, Miss Willoughby, have you ever heard two cats fighting in a backyard? I had to perform it once in a smoking concert at Oxford. It goes like this. Just like that. Oh, Mrs. Twemlow, Mr. Beach, I was telling Miss Willoughby about the cats in London. They were a great trial.
Well, I must say, is it humorous or vulgar?
Oh, certainly humorous, Mr. Beach. Bravo, Mr. Marson. It's quite wonderful.
Really,
it's marvellous.
Marvellous, Mr. Marson.
I'm not so sure, Mrs. Twemlow. This young Marson is getting above himself.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Marson. It was good of you to rescue me.
What a terrible chance you took. You've made yourself a popular success, but you might just as easily have become a social outcast. I sense that Mr. Beach did not approve.
I'm afraid he didn't. In a minute, I'm going to fawn on him and make all well.
By the way, it was quite true what that odious little man said. Freddy Threepwood did write me letters. Of course, I destroyed them long ago.
But weren't you running the risk in coming here that he might recognise you?
I've never met him, and he only saw me on stage. When he greeted our employees at the station this evening, he might have looked a little startled to see me climbing into that cart, but Haley will have told him that my name is Simpson.
That creepy fellow Judson said Freddy was brooding. I think you ought to put him out of his misery.
Freddy is out of his misery. He sent a horrid fat man called Jones to see me in London about the letters, and I told him I destroyed them. He must have let Freddy know that by this time.
I see. Well, in I go to Mr. Beach. Wish me luck. Ah, my dear Mr. Beach, I do hope your swollen feet aren't giving you too much chip. Ditto your stomach lining.
Mr. Marson, I should be sorry to find you was getting above yourself.
I appreciate your concern. I shall endeavour to be careful. And now, may I perhaps raise the subject of the Blandings Castle Museum?
Eh?
I wonder, have you seen Lord Emsworth's newest exhibit?
Indeed. I have seen the scarab which Mr. Peters has presented to his lordship. I understand his lordship thinks very highly of Mr. Peters' scarab.
I wonder, Mr. Beach, whether you might take me to see Lord Emsworth's museum.
After dinner, Mr. Peters had strolled to the main hall of the castle because its solitude suited his mood. It was only after he'd finished a cigar that it suddenly flashed on him that he had, ready at hand, a solution of all his troubles. A brief minute's resolute action, and the scarab would be his again, and the menace of Ash Marson a thing of the past. He glanced about him. Then, making up his mind, he leapt into the museum. His twitching fingers were about to close on his treasure when...
Taking a little look at our collection, Mr. Peters.
Oh! Baxter!
You will see that we have given the place of honour to your Cheops. It is certainly a wonderfully fine specimen.
Oh, sure, yeah. Oh, sure. You gave me quite a start.
My apologies, Mr. Peters. May I perhaps interest you in our remarkable collection of Roman coins?
Oh, pardon me, gentlemen. I was not aware that you were in occupation of the museum. I would not have intruded, but this young man expressed a desire to examine the exhibits, and I took the liberty of conducting him.
Exactly.
I see.
Oh, sure. Come in, Beach. Just come in. Marson... I'll see you later.
Oh, Beach.
Sir?
Just a moment. Come out again. Into the hall?
Certainly, sir.
Beach, who is that man?
He is Mr. Peters' valet, sir.
Mr. Peters' valet?
Yes, sir.
Before dinner, he addressed me as old man. He said pip-pip to me. Has he been in service long?
He has only just joined Mr. Peters, sir, and he has never been in service before. I was unable to elicit from him any information as to his antecedents. His manner struck me as peculiar. I fear Mr. Peters might have been deceived, sir.
Yes.
Or should he be informed, sir?
Who?
Mr. Peters, sir, in case he should have been deceived.
No. Mr. Peters knows his own business.
Far from me be it to appear officious, sir, but...
Tell me, Beach. Who was it suggested this visit to the museum? Did you?
It was at the young man's express desire that I conducted him, sir.
Was it, Beach? Was it?
At 1:05 in the morning, Ash deemed it prudent to give the Blandings household another hour in which to settle down, after which he would just trot along and collect the scarab. The novel he'd brought with him from London fortunately proved interesting. At 2:00, he slipped the book into his pocket and found his way to the green baize door. In the hall, all was still and uncommonly dark.
Right. Precisely 17 steps to the door of the museum. 1, 2...
Oh!
What? Good Lord! I say! Oh. Miss Valentine? Is that you?
It's me.
What are you doing here?
It's 2 in the morning. Don't be alarmed, Mr. Marson.
No, I'm...
You see, I can explain.
In the first of 2 parts of Something Fresh by P.G. Wodehouse, Ash Marson was played by Ewan Griffith and Joan Valentine by Helen McCrory. J. Preston Peters was played by Hector Elizondo and Rupert Baxter by Jared Harris. George Emerson James Frayn, Aileen Peters, Andrea Bowen, Mrs. Twemlow, Jill Gascoigne, Miss Willoughby, Joanne Whalley, and the Earl of Emsworth, Martin Jarvis. Beach the Butler was played by Morgan Shepherd, Adams by Kenneth Danziger, the Orn Freddy Threepwood, Matthew Wolfe, Mr. Judson, Darren Richardson, Mr. Jones, Mr. Ferris, and the Porter, Alan Shearman, and all the maids were played by Maura Quirk. Ian Ogilvy was the voice of P.G. Woodhouse. Something Fresh was dramatised by Archie Scottney, directed by Martin Jarvis, and is a Jarvis and Ayres production for BBC Radio 4.
And tomorrow, the rivalry between Ash and Joan to secure the precious scarab will become intense, and Lord Emsworth will keep a shotgun by him in case of midnight marauders. You can hear the second and final part of Something Fresh at the same time tomorrow. Next week here on Radio 4 Extra, there's an adaptation of the groundbreaking novel by Wilkie Collins. Written in 1859 and considered to be among the first mystery novels, The Woman in White is the story of a young teacher, Walter Hartwright, dispatched to Cumberland to teach the two sisters of Limeridge House. But an encounter with a troubled woman alters his relationship with the family.
I had an uneasy sense that in helping her I might have done wrong. At the same time, however, I didn't know how I could have done right.
Have you seen a woman pass this way? A young woman, in a white gown. She's escaped from my asylum.
The mysterious meeting immerses Hartwright in a search for truth, love, and sanity. Toby Stevens stars in The Woman in White, beginning on Monday morning at 10.
Two unforgettable names of comedy.
Do forgive me, Vicar. This is Mr. Morgan.
Oh, your vicarship.
I don't recall seeing you in church on Sundays, Mr. Morgan.
No. Well, I go on a Saturday. It's less crowded.
Ladies and gentlemen, Eric Morecambe and Ernie Wise.
You know, I feel really keen after my holiday.
Well, where did you go?
Loch Ness.
How is the wife?
The Eric Morecambe and Ernie Wise Show on BBC Radio 4 Extra starts next Tuesday lunchtime at 12:30 and again in the evening at 8:30.
Oh, lovely. Oh, there's no need to do any more. We can finish on that.
Mel's here next. I'll be back at 5 with more comedy and a trip to Ballylanan.
BBC Radio 4 Extra.
Hello and welcome along to Thursday's 4 o'clock show with me, Mel Gedroych. On the show today, the next episode of our story, James and the Giant Peach, and we've got a giant centipede in distress. The Cloud Men have tipped a gallon of thick purple paint right over his head.
He was purple all over. And now that the paint was beginning to dry and harden, he was forced to sit very stiff and upright, as though he were encased in cement. And all 42 of his legs were sticking out straight in front of him, like rods.
Oh, poor centipede, I love the centipede. Although he did call the Cloudmen imbeciles and then the Peach smashed their rainbow into. Anyway, no wonder they were a bit annoyed. Find out what happens next. Miriam Margolyes will be reading Roald Dahl's classic later in the show. We'll also go to the deepest part of the ocean.
And down at the floor, what can we see here? Bits of coral, a tiny weird fish, some jellyfish. Fantastic.
And we find out if insects really can predict the weather. All coming up on today's 4 o'clock show. But first, it's time for my magical mystery tour. I drop little clues throughout the show and your job is to work them out. Can you guess where we're going before we get there? That's the big question. Let's find out. Today we're off to a destination in Cheshire, to the birthplace of the most successful sailor in Olympic history, Sir Ben Ainslie. So where are we going?
In the town where I was born, lived a man who sailed to sea, and he told us of his life.
On yesterday's show, we went to Craigleith Island in the Firth of Forth in Scotland to find out all about its resident seabirds. The island is a real hotspot for puffins. But also in the Firth of Forth is the Bass Rock, one of the best places to see gannets in the UK. BBC Radio Scotland's Mark Stephen went with Maggie Shedden and Tom Brock of the Scottish Seabird Centre in North Berwick. They were there as the birds were settling in for the summer breeding season.
Is this not amazing? Look at this. This is a giant volcanic plug, and it is alive with these beautiful gannets. Look into the airspace above here. They're just swirling around the rock. The wind is such today that they're just, some of them are hanging in the air up here. It's just magnificent.
It reminds me of, you know, those snow domes you used to get as a kid, where you shook it up and all of a sudden it just became full of these white particles. And that's what it's like.
Very,
and because they're such big birds, you don't get a sense of the scale of this, really.
You don't, until once you start to go closer in. And I think, and even at the moment, look at what you're looking at. Every single white dot there is a gannet's nest, and we haven't even reached April yet. Within the next few couple of months, we'll have the immature birds coming in, you'll have the young chicks hatching, and by the time they're about 5-6 weeks old, they're giant, they're white, they're fluffy, they look ridiculous, they're wonderful.
Yeah.
And this rock will be gleaming. You will see it for miles, whether you come in from the south, the east, the west, wherever. It is just spectacular.
And it's great. We're now getting close to some of the gannets in the water here, and it's when you see the gannets close up, you realise just what magnificent birds they are. Yellow heads, that dagger-like beak, and of course they're so well adapted for plunge diving, for fish hitting the surface of the water about 60 miles an hour. And it's great to see them coming back at this time of year, of course. And they've come a long way, many of them from the west coast of Africa, coming back to the same territory and the same mate. How they find their mate in amongst all that, who knows? But they come back to the same territory and the same mate, and then they've got all this behaviour. They meet each other with this beak fencing.
Mm-hmm.
Wonderful to watch. And then when they're here, of course, they travel quite large distances to catch fish. And we now know from satellite tracking they'll go as far as the coast of Norway to catch fish to bring back to the Bass Rock.
On a daily basis.